While we scared away the three regulars that were here earlier, we now have about 45 irregulars. And looking at the faces and knowing where some of you live, this should be slightly more regular place for all of us. It's a great place. Those of us who want to hold an event here like we do right now, you should talk to Emily and book it now because she already booked some 15 or so already. And you should get the seasonal Scottish ale while supply lasts, and you should tip well, not only here. Our opening act belonged to Philip Randolph, and he is reading in the second venue that we have here. This is our first Hillman City, exclusively Hillman City Rainier Valley Liquor, the first one. So you will not get too much exercise tonight. The longest walk you will have is about two blocks away, that side, to Big Chicky. Now, Big Chicky, I know the name sounds a bit tacky, and I'm a big vegetarian. But let me tell you, being vegetarian, I was a bit hesitant, as I just mentioned. But let me assure you, they have amazing vegetarian as well as vegan options. I'm not kidding. Get the rice and beans and the green spicy sauce. The cheesy potatoes may force vegans to convert. Our next reader and our last reader in this wonderful venue is Mary Eliza Crane, who is a New England native who fell madly, passionately, and desirously in love with the natural world in the northeastern mountains. A transplant to the Cascades foothills in the Pacific Northwest, her voice now lives in the understory of fog, forest, and river. Her poetry, a fusion of the natural, political, and intimate world. A regular feature at poetry venues in the Puget Sound region, she has read poetry from Woodstock to LA. Mary has been published in several journals and anthologies, and her third volume of poetry will be published by Moonpath Press this year. Please welcome Mary.
Thank you. So in a few weeks, we're going to celebrate a cultural holiday, and I'd like to share a little bit about what it actually means to be Irish. It's called potato eyes. We have another mouth to feed, yet comes springtime, a box full of potatoes sprouting eyes, stretching into shoots aimed for the light, left over for the new season seed. It was a winter thick with orange pumpkin rolled out into pies, a freezer full of cider, berries, pesto, squash, and sauce, bags of oats and parsnip stew, kale, leeks, and beets keeping cool in the rain-pounded ground. Sometimes the eggs were warm from hen straight to the pan. And if this hadn't been enough, there was a paycheck twice a month and a grocery store in town. The potato sprouts were nameless, purple, yellow, red, and white, fingerling to softball size, but none were Irish lumpers. Before 1845, four of 10 rural Irish ate no solid food except potatoes. Sat together around a basket, peeled the jackets with their nails, and dipped in salt. Washed them down with buttermilk, milk and potatoes, mashed potatoes, simple fare on small stony farms for the strongest peasants in Europe. Spores borne on the wind and rain, phytophthora water mold alighted on green leaves and washed down through the soil. Digging tubers black and foul, how the hungry Celtic farmers howled. Some built roads to nowhere, made half a shilling for some meal. Others to the workhouse, where they dressed in penal garb and pointed shoes. Cottages were tumbled, families turned out on the road, drifted round the land in search of food. Desperately they died. They died in ditches, fields, and hovels, with swollen limbs and bellies, from famine fever, typhus, in towns with names like Skibbereen and Skull. Many left on coffin ships, dead before arrived, but some stayed on, and somehow some survived. I don't know how those who survived, survived in Kerry, on the remote southwestern shore. I know Johanna, Patrick, Jeremiah, but they came later. I don't know those who stood before and lived through famine. Did they scale down rocky cliffs for seabird eggs, scavenge kelp and whelk in tattered rags, bury emaciated babies by the score? The only thing I know about those ravaged souls, in a land of poets, peasants, rebels, thieves, behind the hunger in their eyes and their lost stories, is the same undaunted blue as is in mine. My grandmother's diary, heavy as her rosary beads worn smooth, heavy with the weight of one finger alone removed from a body bag while her oldest son was still imprisoned in a German camp. She quit her job. This woman who knew poverty and the heavy hand of God, she quit her job unloading war dead from transport planes. Catherine Boland Crane knew poverty and the gravid weight of her husband's heart attack. He saved a hard luck neighbor endeavoring to die at the end of an exhaust pipe. Instead, John died and left her with the gravid weight of babes in arms, her sister, four small children, and Jesus on the cross in every room. A small old house, a little spot of bottomland on the Mill River, the Irish ghetto in Florence, Massachusetts. Along with Jesus, she turned the other cheek. In Florence, Massachusetts, they make caskets, and the meek shall inherit the earth. The earth made of turnip, potatoes, and cabbage, Latin and children. Weary fingers pointed towards a less than gentle God. Irish Wake. An Irish wake is not a shot of whiskey, though 700 years of occupation might have made it so. Jeremiah faked his death by drowning, stowed away west across the sea, left behind the girl his family chose, but married one from home. She smoked a pipe and kept her whiskey by the bed. At least, that's the way the family story reads. In truth, this youngest of 20 starving sons had not one inch of rocky land for potatoes struck by blight, on a verdant island blessed by fertile earth. Irish babes and children died with grass stains on their lips, farmers crushed from tenant rents, keening papists bearing crosses every one. Famine raged across the land while onions, mutton, milk, and rye sailed straight across the sea to fatten up the landlords to the east. A generation later, Tom Crane railed against the stone-hard smallness of the farm. At 15, joined the Navy of the Queen. Thrice and back survived the Southern cold. Found and buried Robert Scott. Endurance trapped in ice and broke, Tom kept his humor and good wit while stranded 2 years on the Weddell Sea. Back home in Kerry, Tom fell into obscurity. The Irish love their bloodied martyrs better than a grinning, scruffy hero from the sea. On Easter Monday, 1916, the Brotherhood in Dublin declared Irish independence, resisted the oppressors for a week. Too many died with Padraic Pearse and John McBride. While making peace, Skeffington was gunned down in the streets. When 15 faced the firing squad, the people woke and took up arms. With much more blood and whiskey, they split the map and drove the British to a corner of the land. Mothers cried and poets sang, and no one gave much thought to the exploits of Tom Crane. The other Tommy Crane was my baby brother, whose loving little heart gave out when I was 3. From a culture schooled in loss, my father kept his silence with his God and held a wake that lasted 20 years. Our skin is white, our eyes are blue, we look just like the ruling class. They changed our names on both sides of the sea. When they took the land and gave back whiskey, facing famine and eviction, we ate grass or rode the Irish wake with the next wind. I have my own small piece of rocky, fertile earth, but named both my children for the sea. Something a little lighter, this is called My Daughter Kills a Cockroach in the Trump Tower. This is not an allegory. I raised her in the woods where she picked nettles in fairy dresses and rubber boots, learned to light a fire from a spark. Of course, she moved into the city when she turned 17, got a degree, and worked for a while counting fish. Still wanting bigger, she moved to New York City with grander plans. In need of work, she took a job with a brokerage on Wall Street, what she calls her cosmic joke. The women, high-heeled blondes, overdressed like bimbos. The men, spoiled, young, mean, and holding all the power. The entire firm underwater and in trouble with the SEC. Day by day, she answers phones in boredom, ignored, until the morning the cockroach appeared. The women squeamish in their dagger heels, the grown-up boys too arrogant to deal. She rose from her phones, declared, "It's just a bug," and squished it flat. For one brief moment, they noticed her and tipped their hats. This is called The Red Wheelbarrow, after the poem of the same name by William Carlos Williams. So much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. That's his poem. This is mine. William Carlos Williams, nothing depends upon your unused red wheelbarrow, glazed in the rain or glinting in the sun. Devoid of scratches, rust, or soil, there is no dull bleached patina on what little color might remain. Your wheelbarrow stands proudly beaming on a stiff inflated tire beside a gleaming white chicken, a still life for a seed catalog, which only lacks completion by a perfect patch of peas. William Carlos Williams, have you ever pushed a wheelbarrow weighted down with bricks or soil or potatoes and felt the tire going soft? Or felt surprised at how she pivots through a tight corner with grace unexpected from a clunky tool? Have you ever run outside to upend her from the rain? Do you know that chickens take dust baths to cool off on hot days and lay eggs and defecate from the same orifice? I wash off the soft brown mass in warm water before selling them to unsuspecting poet friends. William Carlos Williams, the dirty little secret is, so much depends upon dirt. Eggs and potatoes, peas and poetry. The man who pushes your wheelbarrow, grimy, sweaty, and hungry, the man who grows your bread. One more. Ring of fire. At the wane of a long season of heat-filled yellow sky, fire consumes mountain forests decimated and infested by bark beetles feasting in their own changing world. I swim deliciously in a warmer river without current, cringing at banks so barren I could walk across. The water is too hot for salmon to return upstream and spawn. Earth degrades to dirt, crumbles in my hand. Early spring bloomed in a riot of fragrant hawthorn flower, unfamiliar nesting songbirds, rare sun, and blueberries found and eaten before breakfast, while deer were still bedded down with stumbling fawns. When drought was only a word to justify smug satisfaction toward the bigger state further south. I want to have one last love affair with the earth before we both die, too decrepit and worn to fall into deep passion and wet ecstasy in one another's arms. Give me time, I'm asking for time. Give me soft moss, give me great chasms of awe. Sweep me off a windy mountain, plunge me into watery depths over and over again. I remain insatiable. I stand feebly against the apocalypse with pickled beets and heirloom beans, broccoli, lettuce, and parsnip seed, four cords of seasoned maple for the winter. I stand only as tall as I dare against the machine. Dread of the San Andreas fault dropping a chunk of the California coast into the sea is an old 20th century anxiety. Doomsday now resides in the Cascadian subduction zone, admiring the view while the Juan de Fuca plate slides under the North American continent. I don't want to grow old together in futile observation of aches and pains and broken ecosystems, losing my teeth and my breath while my beloved earth sheds species, withered and dry, raging against the dying of the light. I'd rather go out in one catastrophic orgasm, landslide crashing down behind me, vast tsunami wall rising up in front, great maw, ring of fire, swallow me inside, no burning, keening carcass left to find. Thank you.